He dropped the edge of the bedspread to the floor. He hadn't realized the sliding glass door was unlocked. He heard Crystal's voice. "Now I've got the Fletch story to cap all Fletch stories. Tousle-headed Fletch kneeling by his bed, lisping, 'Now I lay me down with sheep.'" Crystal was in the doorway, her fat twice banded by a black bikini. "I met a Methodist minister on the airplane the other day." He stood up. 12,000 meters up, he taught me to sing, "Nearer, my God, to thee." He had never seen so much restrained by so little before. "I'm cold," she said. "My room's way the other side of the hotel. May I use your shower?" "Of course." Her skin was beautiful. All of it. Walking across the room, her fat shook so it looked as if it would plop to the floor in handsful. "That idiot Stuart Poynton," she said, "had me standing waist-deep in the pool for a half hour, talking, trying to get me to do legwork for him."
"Legwork?"
"On the Walter March murder. Someone told Poynton I'm unemployed." She left the bathroom door open.
"Did you agree?"
"I told him I'd work for Pravda first."
"Why did you listen?"
Nude, she was adjusting the shower curtain. Even reaching up, her belly hung down.
"Find out if he knew anything. He had some big story about the desk clerk being afraid March was going to get him fired for being so rude to Mrs. March, so he grabbed the desk scissors, let himself into March's suite with the master key, and ventilated Walter March as he stood."
Fletch said, "Where does Poynton get stupid stories like that?"
Crystal stepped into the tub behind the shower curtain.
"Oh, well," he said.
Fletch stripped and went into the bathroom. He held the shower curtain aside and said, "Room for two of us in here? Watch where you step." Under the shower, Crystal's body created the most remarkable cascade.
"Did you bring a sandwich?" she asked. "Anything to eat?"
"Young lady, if it's the last thing I do, and it may be, I'm going to teach you not to make disparaging remarks about yourself."
"Nothing to eat, huh?"
"I didn't say that."
"Oh, I've never gone for these high-protein diets."
"Obviously. Repeat after me. I will never insult myself again."
"I will never insult..." "Yipes!"
When they fell sideways out of the tub, the shower curtain and the bar holding it came with them. On the bathroom floor, they tried to unwrap themselves from the shower curtain. Part of it was under them on the floor.
"God damn it," he said. "You're on my leg, my left leg."
"I don't feel a thing," she said.
I do. Get off."
"I can't. The shower curtain..."
"Jesus, will you get off my leg? Christ, I think you broke it."
"What do you mean I broke it? Men are supposed to take some responsibility for situations like this."
"How can I take responsibility when I'm pinned to the floor?"
"You're no good to me pinned to the floor."
"Will you get off my damned leg?"
"Get the shower curtain off me."
"How can I get the shower curtain off? I can't move."
The shower curtain was yanked, pulled, lifted off from the top. Frederica Arbuthnot stood there in tan culottes and a blouse, shower curtain in hand. Fletch said,
"Oh, hi, Freddy."
"Nice to see you, Fletch, finally."
"Thanks."
Crystal had rolled off him. Freddy said, "You make a very noisy neighbor." She dropped the shower curtain and left. Fletch was sitting up, feeling up and down his left leg with his fingers. Face down on the floor, Crystal said, "Did I break it?"
"You didn't break anything."
"You really turn her on, you know."
"Who?"
"Freddy."
Fletch said, "Oh, a bush in the hand." Chapter 23. 6 p.m. Cocktails. Amanda Hendricks' room.
"Did you have a nice shower?" Freddy asked.
"Thanks for rescuing us. Quite an impasse."
"Oh, any time. Really, Fletch, you ought to wear a whistle around your neck for situations of that sort."
In the Amanda Hendricks room, Fletch stood with a Chivas Regal and soda in hand, Freddy with a vodka gimlet. Since he had entered the room, Leona Hatch had been eyeing him curiously.
"And," asked Freddy, "do you always sing at play?"
"Was I singing?"
"Something of doubtful appropriateness. I believe it was 'Nearer, my God, to thee.'"
"No, no. For Crystal, I was singing 'Nearer, my God, to thee.'"
"Such a happy child."
Leona Hatch swayed over to Fletch and said,
"Don't I know you?"
She would make it to dinner tonight, but just barely.
My name's Fletcher. He put out his hand. I am Fletcher. Leona took his hand uncertainly.
I don't recognize the name, she said, but I'm sure I know you from somewhere.
I've never worked in Washington.
Maybe on one of the presidential campaigns.
I've never covered one.
Funny, she said, I have the feeling I know you very well.
You probably do, muttered Freddy. You probably do. Don Gibbs and another man appeared behind Leona Hatch. Gibbs's face was highly flushed.
Fletcher, old man!
Almost knocking Leona Hatch over, in fact, knocking her hat askew, Don Gibbs, drink in hand, made a clumsy effort to embrace Fletcher's shoulders.
Ha-ha! Fletch said. Ha-ha!
They remained standing in a circle while Fletch looked into his glass and remained quiet. Don Gibbs, his face highly decorated with smiles, finally said,
Well, Fletch, aren't you going to introduce us?
Still looking into his glass, Fletch shrugged. Oh, I'm sure you all know each other. He looked up in time to see an odd flicker in Frederick Arbuthnot's left eye. Leona was resettling her hat on her head at a completely wrong angle.
Well, I don't know who they are. Who the hell are they?
Oh, Ms. Hatch, I'm sorry, Fletch said. This is Donald Gibbs, and this is Robert Englehart. They work for the Central Intelligence Agency. Ms. Leona Hatch. Gibbs's smile sank down his face, his neck, and disappeared somewhere beneath a shirt collar. Englehart, a large man in a loose brown suit, turned white all over his bald head. Freddy said, You have the CIA on the brain. Fletch shrugged again. And frankly, Ms. Hatch, I have no idea who this young lady is. Englehart stepped forward and grabbed Leona's free hand in his paw.
Delighted to meet you, Ms. Hatch. Mr. Gibbs and I are observers at your convention. We're from the Canadian Press. We're planning a convention of our own next year in Ontario.
You don't sound Canadian, she said.
Pip, said Gibbs. Pip, pip, pip.
Pop, said Fletcher.
Pup. See what I mean? Asked Leona. Since when have Canadians said pip?
Englehart, the top of his bald head dampish, gave Fletch a killing look.
And you pronounced the word observers wrong, too.
Leona Hatch shook her arm.
Mister, you're hurting my hand.
Oh, I'm sorry. Englehart not only released her hand, but in doing so took a step backward, thus tipping Leona Hatch a little forward. This time she caught herself. She said,
A Canadian would have said, I am sorry, with the stress on the am. A Canadian never would have contracted I and am in that sentence under those circumstances.
Don Gibbs had taken several steps backward. He continued to look as if tons of lava were flowing toward him. Freddy said,
Miss Hatch, I'm Frederick Arbuthnot. I work for Newsworld magazine.
Nonsense, sniffed Leona. No one works for Newsworld magazine.
Ah, here's the beautiful young couple.
Arms extended to embrace the whole world, Helena Williams entered the group.
Hello, Leona. Everything all right?
Helena looked at Gibbs and Englehart curiously. They took several more steps backward.
Fletch and...
She was looking at Freddy.
I forget your name.
So does she, said Fletch.
Frederica Arbuthnot, she said. For short, you may call me Miss Blake. You know, Leona, I offer these young people the bridal suite, but they insist they're not married. What's the world coming to?
Great improvement, said Leona Hatch. Great improvement.
Fletch said, Helena, I haven't seen Jake around much.
Well, you know, he's trying to spend as much time with Junior as he can. And with Walter gone, well, someone has to make the decisions. Junior isn't quite up to it yet.
She gave the back of her hair a push.
I'm afraid Jake isn't enjoying this convention much. None of us is, I suppose.
In case I don't see Jake, be sure and say hello to him for me, Fletch said. Helena put her arms out again to flap to another group.
I surely will, Fletch.
There was a hoarse whisper in Fletch's right ear.
What the hell do you think you're doing?
Fletch turned to face Don Gibbs and Robert Englehart. He said, Have you ever tried to lie to someone like Leona Hatch?
She's crocked, Gibbs said.
Have you ever tried to lie to someone like Leona Hatch even when she's crocked?
Englehart was looking exceedingly grim.
She'd pin your wings to a board in 1 minute flat, Fletch said. In fact, if you noticed, that's exactly what she did do.
Crystal Fione came through a crowd to them, casting quite a bow wave.
Ms. Crystal Fione, Fletch intoned, allow me to introduce you to Mr. Robert Englehart and Mr. Donald Gibbs, both of the Central Intelligence Agency.
Englehart's eyes closed and opened slowly. Gibbs's sweaty upper lip was quivering. Crystal said, "Hi." She turned to Fletch. "I stayed in my room to watch Lewis Graham on the evening news show. You know what he did?"
"You tell me."
"He did a 90-second editorial on the theme that people should retire when they say they're going to, regardless of how much they have to give up, using Walter March as an example."
"We wrote that form at lunch," Fletch said.
"I think we can say we contributed to it."
"Did he use the same biblical quotes?"
"Identical."
"Well," said Fletch, "at least one always knows Lewis Graham's sources. May I escort you to the dining room, Miss Fione?"
"Oh, goody. Will we be the first ones there? I so like having a perfect record at the things I do."
"Miss Fione," Fletch said, crossing through the cocktail party, her arm in his, "I've just figured something out."
"Who murdered Walter March?"
"Something much more important than that."
"What could be more important than that?"
"The reverse. Death in the presence of life, life in the presence of death."
Crystal said, "Funny the way riddles have always made me hungry."
"Crystal, darling, this afternoon you were trying to get pregnant."
Immediately she said, "Think we succeeded?"
"Oh, Lord."
"If you remember, I always was very good at math."
They were in the dining room.
"Crystal, sit down."
"Oh, nice, he's taking care of me already."
She sat in the chair he held out for her.
"Not to worry, Fletcher."
"I promise.
There's just no way I can be unemployed 9 months from now. Good heavens, I'd starve."
He was sitting next to her at the empty round table.
"Crystal, you lost a job before this way. It's an unfair world. You said yourself nothing has changed."
"Oh, yes, it has," she said.
"Walter March is dead."
Chapter 24. 7:30 p.m. Dinner. Main dining room.
"Frankly, I think you're all being dreadfully unfair."
Eleanor Earls put her napkin next to her coffee cup.
"I've never heard so many spiteful, vicious remarks about one man in all my life as I've heard about Walter March since coming here to Hendricks Plantation."
Fletch was at the round table for six with three women. Eleanor Earls, Crystal Fione, and, of course, Freddy Arbuthnot. No Robert McConnell, no Lewis Graham.
"You all act and talk like a bunch of nasty children in a reformatory, gloating because the biggest boy among you got knifed, rather than like responsible, concerned journalists and human beings."
Crystal burped.
"What have we said?" asked Freddy.
In fact, their conversation had been fairly neutral, mostly concerning the arrival of the Vice President of the United States the next afternoon, discussing who would play golf with him. Tom Lockhart, Richard Baldridge, and Sheldon Levy. Oscar Perlman had invited him to a strip poker party to prove he had nothing to hide. And whether his most attractive wife would accompany him. Freddy had just mentioned the memorial service for Walter March to be held in Hendricks the next morning.
"Oh, it's not you." Eleanor looked resentfully around the dining room. "It's all these other twerps."
Eleanor Earls was a highly paid network news person, attractive enough, but resented by many because she had done commercials while working for another network, which most journalists refused to do, and despite that, now had one of the best jobs in the industry. Many felt she would not have been able to overcome her background and be so elevated if she had not been seized upon by the networks as their token woman. Nevertheless, she was extremely able.
"Walter March," she said, "was an extraordinary journalist, an extraordinary publisher, and an extraordinary human being."
"He was extraordinary, all right," Crystal said into her parfait.
"He had a great sense of news, of the human story, of trends, how to handle a story. His editorial sense was almost flawless. And when March newspapers came out for or against something, it was seldom wrong. I doubt Walter March was ever wrong."
"Oh, come now," Fletch said.
"What about the way he handled people?" Crystal asked. "What about the way he treated his own employees?"
"Let me tell you," Eleanor said, "I would have considered it a privilege to work for Walter March, any time, any place, under any circumstances."
"You never worked for him," Crystal said.
Eleanor said, "You know about the time I was stuck in Albania, when I was working for the other network?"
Fletch remembered vaguely an incident several years before, one of those three-day wonder stories concerning Eleanor Earls in a foreign land. He was a teenager when it happened. It was the first he had ever heard of Eleanor Earls.
"It was just one of those terribly frightening things." Eleanor sat forward, her hands folded slightly below her chin. "I and a producer, Sarah Pulling, had spent 5 days in Albania shooting one of those in-country documentary-type features for the network. Needless to say, we'd had to use an Albanian film crew, and needless to say, we could only film what they wanted us to, when they wanted us to, and how they wanted us to. However, getting any film, any story out of Albania was considered a coup. It had taken months of diplomatic back and forth. Of course, they had to accept me as an on-camera person, and I figured if I kept my eyes and ears open, I'd be able to add plenty of material and additional comments to the soundtrack once we got back to New York. Despite their ordering us this way and that and putting us up in their best hotel, which had the ambience of a chicken coop, I think they tried to be kind to us. They offered us so much food and drink so continuously, Sarah said she was sure it was their way of preventing us from doing any work at all. So things went along fairly well under the circumstances. We hadn't much control over what we had on film, but we knew we had something. The night we were leaving, we packed up and were driven to the airport by some of the people who had been assigned to be our hosts and work with us. It was all very jolly. There were even hugs and kisses at the airport before they left us to wait for the plane. Then we were arrested. After we had gone through all the formalities of leaving Albania, most of which we didn't even understand, and were actually at the gate, ready to board, two men approached us, took us out of the line, said nothing until everyone else had passed us, boarding the plane, until all the airline's personnel had gone about other business, all those eyes carefully averted from the two American women standing silent and somewhat scared with two Albanian bulldogs. After everyone had left, they took us by our elbows, marched us through the airport and into a waiting car. We were brought back into the city, stripped, searched, dressed in sort of short, loose cotton house dress kinds of things that allowed us to freeze, and put in individual, rank, filthy jail cells. Fed those things that look like whole wheat biscuits in pans of cold water, three a day for 3 days. No one official ever saw us, no one spoke to us, we were never questioned. Our protests and efforts to get help, get something official happening, got us nowhere. The people who brought us our biscuits and removed our pails just shrugged and smiled sweetly. 3 days of this. Have you ever been in such circumstances? It's an unreasonable thing. And you find yourself reasoning if they can do it for a day, they can do it for a month. 2 days, why not a year? 3 days, why not keep you in jail the rest of your life? I was sure the network would be yelling at the State Department, and the State Department doing whatever one does under such circumstances. And yes, all that was happening. It was a big news item in the United States and Europe. The network made plenty of hay out of it. They pulled their hair and gnashed their teeth on camera. They made life miserable for several people at the State Department. However, they didn't do whatever was necessary under the circumstances to get us out of jail. The afternoon of the fourth day, two men showed up in the corridor between Sarah's and my cells. One of them was an Albanian national. The other was the chief of the Rome Bureau of March newspapers. You know what he said? He said, "How are you doing?" Someone unlocked our cells. The two men walked us out of the building, without a word to anyone, and put us, shivering, filthy, stinking, into the back seat of a car. At the airport, the two men shook hands. The March newspaper's bureau chief sat in the seat behind us on the way to Rome, never saying a word. At the airport in Rome, all the other passengers were steered into customs. An Italian policeman took the three of us through a different door, into a reception area, and there, seated in one chair, working from an open briefcase in another chair, was Walter March. I had never met him before. He glanced up when we came in, got up slowly, closed his briefcase, took it in one hand, and said, "All right." He drove us into a hotel in Rome, made sure we were checked in, saw us to a suite, and then left us. An hour later, we were overcome by our own network people. He must have called them and told them where we were. I didn't see Walter March again for years. I sent him many full messages of gratitude, I can tell you, but I was never sure if any got through to him. I never had a response. When I finally did meet him at a reception in Berlin, you know what he said? He said, "What? Someone was impersonating me in Rome? That happens." Freddy said, "Nice story." Crystal said, "It brings a tear to my eye." "Saintly old Walter March," Fletch said. "I've got to go, if you'll all excuse me." During dinner, he had received a note, delivered by a bellman, written on hotel stationery, with Mr. I. Fletcher on the envelope, which read, "Dear Fletch, didn't realize you were here until I saw your name in McConnell's piece in today's Washington paper. Please come see me as soon after dinner as you can. Suite 12, Lydia March." He had shown the note to no one. Crystal had expressed curiosity by saying, "For someone unemployed, you sure get interrupted at meals a lot. No wonder you're slim. When you're working, you must never get to eat." Eleanor Earls said, "I take it you've worked for Walter March?" I have, said Crystal. I have, said Fletch. Freddy smiled and said, no.
And he was tough on you? Eleanor asked.
No, said Crystal. He was rotten to me.
Fletch said nothing. Eleanor said to both of them,
I suspect you deserved it.
Chapter 25. 9 p.m. There's a time and a place for humor. Washington, now. Address by Oscar Perlman. The door to Suite 12 was opened to Fletch by Jake Williams, notebook and pen in hand, looking drawn and harassed.
Fletcher!
They shook hands warmly. Lydia, in a pearl-gray house gown, was standing across the living room, several long pieces of yellow teletype paper in one hand, reading glasses in the other. Her pale blue eyes summed up Fletch very quickly, and not unkindly.
Nice to see you again, Fletch, she said.
Fletch was entirely sure they had never met before.
We'll be through in 1 minute, she said. Just some things Jake has to get off tonight.
Leaving Fletch standing there, she put her glasses on her nose and began working through the teletype sheets, talking to Jake.
I don't see any reason why we have to run the San Francisco story from AP. Can't our own people in San Francisco work up a story for ourselves?
It's a matter of time, Jake said, making a note. Pooh, said Lydia, the story isn't going to die in 6 hours.
6 hours?
If our people can't come up with our own story on this within 6 hours, then we need some new staff in San Francisco, Jake.
Mrs. March, Fletch said. She looked at him over the frame of her glasses.
May I use your John?
Of course, she pointed with her glasses. You have to go through the bedroom.
Thank you.
When he came back to the living room, she was sitting on the divan, demitasse service on the coffee table in front of her, not a piece of paper, not even her glasses in sight. She said, sit down, Fletch. He sat in a chair across the coffee table from her.
Has Jake left?
Yes, he has a lot to do. Would you care for some coffee?
I don't use it.
He was wondering if his marvelous machine was picking up their conversation. He supposed it was. He wondered what Mrs. March would say if he began singing Gordon Lightfoot's The Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald as he had promised the machine he would.
Fletch, I understand you're not working.
She was pouring herself coffee.
On a book.
Oh, yes, she said, the journalist's pride. Whenever a journalist hasn't got a job, he says he's working on a book. How many times have I heard it? Sometimes, of course, he is. What's keeping the wolf from the door?
My ugly disposition.
She smiled slightly.
I've heard so much about you from one source or another. You were one of my husband's favorite people. He loved to tell stories about you.
I understand people like to tell outrageous stories about me. I've heard one only lately. Highly imaginative.
I think you and my husband were very much alike.
Mrs. March, I met with your husband for 5 minutes one day in his office. It was not a successful meeting for either of us.
Of course not. You were too much alike. He had a lot of brashness, you know.
Whenever he was presented with alternatives, he always thought up some third course of action no one else had considered. That's about what you do, isn't it?
Instead of saying yes or no, Fletch said, maybe.
My point is this, Fletch. Walter is dead.
I'm sorry I didn't say you have my sympathy.
Thank you. March newspapers will need a lot of help. Everything now falls on Junior's shoulders. He's every bit the man his father was, of course, even better in many ways, but...
She fitted her coffee cup to its saucer.
This death, this murder...
It must be a great shock to Junior.
He's lived so much in his father's... They were great friends.
Mrs. March, I'm a working stiff. I'm a reporter. I know how to get a story and maybe how to write it. In a pinch, I can work on a copy desk. I know a good layout when I see one. I know nothing about the publishing side of this business, how you attract advertising and what it costs per line, how you finance a newspaper by machinery.
Junior does. He's really very good at the backroom mechanics of this business.
She poured herself more coffee.
Fletch, this is very much a horse-and-wagon sort of business. The horse has to be in front of the wagon. What a newspaper looks like and how it reads is the horse, and the wagon it pulls is the advertising and whatnot. If a newspaper isn't exciting and important, you can have all the clever people in the world in the back room and it won't work out as a business.
There's Jake Williams.
Oh, Jake.
She let her hand flop in disparagement.
Jake is sort of old and worn out.
Jake Williams was a good 20 years younger than Lydia March.
What I'm asking you, Fletch, is, Would you help Junior out? He has a terribly tough row to hoe just now.
I doubt he'd want me to.
Why do you say that?
I bumped into him in the bar this afternoon, and we had a little chat.
The bar, the bar.
Her face was annoyed and pained.
Really? Junior's got to pull up his socks, and very soon.
He seems to have some ambivalent feelings toward me.
Junior doesn't know what he feels at the moment. He's keeping himself as drunk as he can. To be frank, I suppose a little bit of that is understandable under the circumstances, but really becoming totally inoperable.
I think he's afraid. Her eyes opened wide.
Afraid?
I never really had a sense of how much your husband was doing, and how he was doing it, until I came to this convention and started hearing the gossip. Your husband's death was pretty ugly. Lydia fitted her back into the corner of the divan and stared at the floor. The lady had much to think about. Mrs. March, more than 5 years ago, your husband announced his retirement, publicly. All the newspapers carried it. Why didn't he retire?
Oh, you heard Lewis Graham tonight on television.
I heard about it.
What a pompous ass.
You know, he ran against my husband last year for the presidency of the AJA, so he takes all the resentment and hatred he has for my husband and turns it into 90 seconds of philosophical network pablum. Why didn't your husband retire when he said he was going to?
You don't know?
No. She was sitting up, looking uneasy.
It was because of that stupid union thing Junior did.
Fletch said, I still don't know.
Well, a huge union negotiation was coming up, and Junior thought he'd be clever. Our board of directors had been putting pressure on him for some years, you know, saying that they thought he had led too sheltered a life, was too naive. They thought all he wanted was to do his day's work and go home at 5 o'clock to his wife. Of course, that was before she left him. They insisted he'd travel more, and of course he did take that trip to the Far East.
Fletch remembered that Junior had filed a dispatch from Hong Kong which began, There are a lot of Chinese, and every March newspaper printed it on the front page faithfully, just to make the son of the publisher look ridiculous, which he did. So I guess Junior wanted to show his father and the board of directors that he had some ideas of his own, could operate in what he thought was a manly manner. Even Walter, my husband, thought the negotiations were going too smoothly. Even points brought up by our side as negotiating points were being accepted, almost without discussion. Of course, some of the union members smelled a rat and began nosing around. Don't you know about this? Walter did his best to keep it quiet. I guess he succeeded. It was discovered that Junior had invested in a large bar restaurant with the president of the labor union.